Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. America wants to take over the world. It's official. Lying, cheating and stealing is how it intends to do it. So James Jatras is one of the first analysts to popularise the term the deep state, as distinct from Congress and the President. A kind of permanent government by banks and corporations and the revolving door into think tanks and universities. Jim worked for 7 years at the US State Department through the 1990s and the collapse of the Soviet Union and also into the early noughties. He has a warning for Boris Johnson: keep a good relationship with Donald Trump, but resist Israeli influence, and above all, don't get into bed with the deep state. He says present tensions with Russia are far more dangerous than during the Cold War, and he explains exactly why. Also, Vladimir Putin has dissolved the government this week as a new prime minister. He's announced free education and healthcare, a kind of old-fashioned, old Labour, socialist system for the Russians. That's not what Yeltsin was looking, promising to bring in. And the Sons of David, the army seminary in Israel, Rabbi Giora Radler is just one recorded teaching young Israelis soon to enter the military that Hitler was right about racism. We hear a Channel 13 Israel TV investigation report from Israeli television with hidden cameras filming teachers. Rabbis saying the Holocaust was not about killing Jews. The real Holocaust is racial equality, if you can believe it. And the Jewish Home Kahan Party, associated with the Sons of David Seminary, may soon be running Israel's education ministry, in charge of educating all Israeli children. That's what the Channel 13 report says. Plus, forget Iran's uranium enrichment or Israel's 200 nuclear weapons for a minute. What about May 1945? While the Manhattan Project was crying out for all the enriched uranium it could get, Hitler committed suicide and Admiral Dönitz was in charge of the dying Reich. And U-234, this submarine. So, who ordered the two Japanese officers on the sub to be shot on the 12th of May and for the submarine to change course to rendezvous with a US destroyer, handing over the enriched uranium to the Americans for the Manhattan Project? Our sister show Dialect here on BCFM on Tuesday at noon. This week, Birmingham journalist Chris Hewitt was chatting with off-duty West Midlands Special Branch in 1974, just after the Birmingham pub bombings. They told him they'd been about to arrest the real perpetrators when Detective George Reed, spelt R-E-A-D-E, head of what they nicknamed the Lying Squad, took over the investigation. Reed went on to wrongfully charge 6 innocent men before retiring to Australia and leaving behind one of the biggest miscarriages of justice in British history, the inside story of the Birmingham pub bombings and the Birmingham Six. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, we start this week where we're speaking to the former State Department advisor Jim Jatras about this incredible tectonic shift, really. Boris Johnson's announced this week what many were suspecting, and that is that Britain thinks that maybe we're just going to have to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal, just like Donald Trump wanted.
Well, I think they're trying to finesse it by saying that they want a different, you know, the Iranians now are supposedly breaking the deal, but they're not, because the Americans have withdrawn from the deal, the sanctions haven't been lifted, and on those circumstances, they're entitled to do, their signatories, the non-proliferation treaty, and they're allowed to develop civil nuclear power. There's nothing, you know, other countries have got civil nuclear power. I'm personally not in favour of it, but if they want to have it, there's no rule
but
that
says
they can't.
But this enriched uranium, we'll be talking about a bit later, back in the end of World War II, is rather precious stuff, isn't it? It can be used to make nuclear weapons.
Well, it can. I mean, the CANDU reactors in India, which were basically, they were basically civil reactors, but they developed their nuclear program on the back of them. And of course, the nuclear industry in this country was spun off the nuclear weapons complex. That's obvious. But the fact is that if we're going to have nuclear power in the world, and I'm afraid it's going to carry on for quite a while longer, there's no absolute legal reason why the Iranians can't have it.
Well,
why
I mean,
not?
This is all a spin-off from the assassination just the new year of General Soleimani, the Iranian general. You pointed out to me, Martin, this great little article from Craig Murray about something called the Bethlehem Doctrine and the illegal murder of Soleimani. Mm-hmm. Now, the incredible thing here is that the Americans are still trying to justify it as legal under international law, and it's quite entertaining, actually, watching them on various outlets, on the radio, the World Service, and Channel 4 News, etc., desperate to say that, well, no, it wasn't an assassination. So what is this Bethlehem Doctrine?
Well, Bethlehem was originally an advisor to the Israeli government. He's a lawyer. He used to advise the Israeli government. And they came up with this idea that you can carry out preemptive strikes on individuals. And of course, the Israelis have carried out loads of assassinations on the grounds that there is an immediate threat. And they have to use the word immediate threat.
Actually, the word is imminent.
Imminent, yes, which of course doesn't mean anything. I mean, basically, an imminent threat. You can just,
an imminent threat or imminent attacks on U.S.
Now,
citizens.
Now, it's not clear that this is legal in international law, and in actual fact, when the British Attorney General and his team said that the Iraq War was illegal, they brought in this guy from Israel to say, you know, it is legal because of this Bethlehem Doctrine. And, of course, Craig Murray, as an ex-ambassador, is very well aware of stuff about international law. He says it's basically a farrago. The guy's basically a shill for the Israelis, and he was brought in by Jack Straw to undermine the British legal profession.
Jesus was right in his rant against lawyers and priests, wasn't he?
Well, that's another topic, certainly. The point is,
well, this is a lawyer. These are the lawyers.
The doctrine,
Martin, is of preemptive self-defense. So what it's saying is it's not actually self-defense from an attack, but it's an attack that you believe is about to take place.
One of the problems the Americans have got is that on the one level, they're saying that there was an imminent attack on the US embassy, hundreds of people were going to die, and then they're also saying, well, no, in actual fact, he was just a bad guy, and we needed to kill him anyway. And that's basically the British government that went along with that. Now, of course, by the same token, the assassination, say, of the head of CENTCOM would be absolutely justifiable, wouldn't it? The Iranians could say, right, we're going to... what was interesting, what Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon said, who's the head of Hezbollah, he said, well, we could go in for a tit-for-tat approach here. They kill Soleimani, we go after somebody at the same level on the other side. But he said, we're not going to do that, because in actual fact, Trump's head isn't worth Soleimani's shoe.
So this new war
we're
creating
going to do is drive the US out of the Middle East by political means.
Legal opinion, which justifies starting World War III, it's rather ironic that it's developed by Daniel Bethlehem.
Well, it is, and of course he's an Israeli citizen and all the rest of it. What's he doing giving legal advice to the British government? But of course what the Israelis have been doing for years, and of course the US, we know the US tried to assassinate Fidel Castro. They killed, US and the MI6 killed Patrice Lumumba. They killed Dag Hammarskjöld, who was the head of the UN. I mean, we've been doing this for years and years and years and years and years, but there's all been plausible deniability. Well, now the covers are coming off the machine guns. Now, we openly say we've got the right to assassinate people if we don't like them. Now, of course, if you're going to move
lawyers will say not because because they're about to kill us.
No, but in actual fact, this Bethlehem Doctrine has never been tested in court. In actual fact, it's rubbish. It's basically
enables the politicians to look at a piece of paper and say, oh, well, it's all legal then. Yeah. Like Blair in the Iraq War.
Well, yes, except it isn't in international law. It just isn't.
But the politicians can walk away because they're saying, well, the legal opinion has told me that it is legal.
All right. Well, I mean, if we're going to move to a situation where we people, you know, but there is no legal, you know, we can take preemptive action. Well, that goes across the board, doesn't it? The Russians can take preemptive action. The Chinese can take preemptive action. The Cubans can take preemptive action. Everybody can take preemptive action.
The Venezuelans can.
Yeah, yeah.
In the Iran crisis, another angle to all of this, the value of top arms firms has risen by £14 billion as the US-Iran standoff fuels expectation of bumper weapon orders.
Well, it's an ill wind that blows nobody to good, eh? I mean, obviously, a lot of what's going on is this huge boondoggle in the US and here of basically weapons production lining the pockets of
I mean,
a corrupt
global
oligarchy.
Arms, just look, take a look at Global Arms Sales. It's Cathal Milmo in the I newspaper, this fantastic little article. It's amazing, mind-boggling figures, really. Global arms sales rose by 5% to $420 billion in 2018. It's around about a 50% rise since 2002. I mean, there's not been lots of inflation since then, has there? But it's almost half as much again as it was in 2002.
Well, what's happening is that capitalism is being hollowed out as a mom-and-pop system for producing consumer goods for ordinary people. And it's morphing into this, essentially, war machine, which basically makes profits through plunder.
And quite a lot of that money that's being spent on arms, you know what? It's being spent in Israel. Israel's weapons industry is earning millions from EU states. It must end, says Gina Dowding in Middle East Eye. At stake is the union's role as a credible and impartial mediator in the Israel-Palestine conflict. So effectively what she's saying this week is that the EU has a big vested interest in keeping things as they are with regards to Israel, because lots and lots of European money is being spent on weapons technology developed in and manufactured in Israel.
That's right. And of course, the Saudis are other big arm spenders. And they're basically pulverizing Yemen as we speak with full support from the British and American armed forces.
I mean, the report she quotes is published by the European Coordination of Committees and Associations for Palestine. It shows the EU has handed out 2 million euros to private weapons manufacturers Elbit Systems and more than 7 million euros to state-owned Israel Aerospace Industries. Between 2014 and 2019, the companies received grants under the EU's programme for research funding. So this is an umbilical cord here.
Yes, of course. And of course, ultimately, what Trump's talking about is expanding NATO to include Israel. And therefore, if Israel's attacked, then NATO is obliged to defend them. We're going to war. We're already at war. And, you know, Brexit.
The big superpowers, of course. You know. The big superpowers, Martin, are China and the United States. But it's fascinating to see that China exploits a fleet of US satellites to strengthen its police and military power. Beijing reaps benefits from the sensitive equipment, despite US law, aided indirectly by private equity giant Carlyle Group and Boeing. So this is a whole network of satellites which is used by the Chinese government for surveillance of its own citizens. Actually, the Americans are talking about human rights. They don't really care about human rights, do they? They're allowing their satellites to be used by the Chinese government to keep an eye on all their citizens.
Well, the fact is that as long as the satellites are there, they can be used. And of course, if it comes to a war, they'll all be shot down. And we'll have to see. We'll then see how the Western military operate with those satellites.
Well, it does make you wonder, doesn't it, whether the politicians in the United States and in China, actually there are corporations that are actually more powerful than they are. They're saying, well, look, we've got all these satellite networks, you can do it a little bit. You know, that there's back channels going on between the two countries.
The whole idea of opening up the Chinese economy to foreign investment and all the rest of it means that you've got total integration with the Chinese are totally integrated into the world capitalist economy, and that includes using all of these physical networks and infrastructures. And that should be something that leads everybody to think, well, war's unthinkable. You know, we're basically so interdependent that war's unthinkable. But of course, ultimately, that means that the US has got to accept that the Chinese ultimately will be bigger and stronger than they are.
Obviously, another idea here, Martin, is that these satellites, the Americans are allowing the Chinese to use them so they can just keep an eye on all their tactics.
Well, exactly. So in other words, everybody's spying on everybody else, and you can do that, but then the other side is spying on you. Look what happened with Snowden. He walked away with one MP3 with all the crown jewels of US spying, just one little guy like him. That's the problem with all of this total surveillance system.
So effectively, the law in the US says you can't do this. You cannot sell satellites to, and you can't. But what they're doing apparently is they're renting them. So it's allowed China to essentially rent the capacity of US satellites that it would never be allowed to buy.
Yeah, and of course the Chinese will be developing their own satellites as well. They don't want to be dependent on anybody else. They want their own show. I mean, the EU has developed its own satellites because it doesn't trust the Americans. The point about satellite technology in general is this. Once a shooting war starts, satellites are sitting tall.
A terrific investigation by the Wall Street Journal, I have to say. Tangled webs of satellite ownership and offshore firms have helped China's government achieve its surveillance goals. Some of America's biggest companies, including private equity firm The Carlyle Group, in addition to Boeing, have facilitated China's efforts, the journal found.
Yeah, it wouldn't be at all surprising, would it? I mean, you know, the filières of modern production of anything, cars, satellites, everything's linked to everything else. You know, the components in your phone have come from all over the world. And everybody, and you know, and if there's a war, all of that interaction will you know, blow up in everybody's face.
Okay, so let's drag this all back to look at the recent confrontation between Iran and the US. It was the weekend before. I didn't have time for it on last week's program, and in a way, I'm glad I didn't, because we can now have a listen to exactly what Donald Trump had to say about the way he felt would be the best way for the Europeans, the Russians, and the Chinese to ditch the Iran nuclear deal after the debacle with the assassination of Soleimani.
In recent months alone, Iran has seized ships in international waters, fired an unprovoked strike on Saudi Arabia, and shot down two U.S. drones. Iran's hostilities substantially increased after the foolish Iran nuclear deal was signed in 2013. And they were given $150 billion, not to mention $1.8 billion in cash. Instead of saying thank you to the United States, they chanted death to America. In fact, they chanted death to America the day the agreement was signed. Then Iran went on a terror spree, funded by the money from the deal, and created hell in Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, Afghanistan, and Iraq. The missiles fired last night at us and our allies were paid for with the funds made available by the last administration. The regime also greatly tightened the reins on their own country, even recently killing 1,500 people at the many protests that are taking place all throughout Iran. The very defective JCPOA expires shortly anyway and gives Iran a clear and quick path to nuclear breakout. Iran must abandon its nuclear ambitions and end its support for terrorism. The time has come for the United Kingdom, Germany, France, Russia, and China to recognize this reality. They must now break away from the remnants of the Iran deal, or JCPOA. And we must all work together toward making a deal with Iran that makes the world a safer and more peaceful place.
Well, I mean, all that stuff about, and you mentioned Yemen there, which is terrible. It's probably the worst humanitarian catastrophe on the planet. And it's not the Iranians that are making the mess. It's the Saudis, backed up, as I said earlier, by British and US military personnel. And, you know, there's a potential famine, cholera, all the rest of it. And that's not the Iranians, that's the Americans. And all this stuff about the Iranians are involved in politics in the Middle East, just as Britain's involved in politics in Europe. Why is the United States sticking its finger in?
Well, it's
thousands of miles away.
Well, it's not thousands, it's 6,000 miles away, whereas Tehran from Baghdad, whereas Tehran is about 600 miles away.
Well, that's right. And of course, the fact of the matter is that the Americans think that Iran is completely surrounded by US bases. Completely surrounded.
Anyway, so
how dare they have their country surrounded by the bases?
Around about a week after that call by Trump for UK, Germany, France, Russia, and China to leave the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, I think it stands for, we had appalling interview by a chap called Dan Walker, who seems as if he's like straight out of public school, and he's suddenly given the most important job of a 30-minute interview with Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, and he was rambling all over the place, but he did manage to get Boris to talk about the Soleimani assassination and the whether or not we are still in or out of this joint comprehensive plan of action, which apparently only the Americans have left, not the British. We are still in it.
The UK played its traditional role, which is to serve as the bridge between the European powers.
But is the UK's traditional role to not be told about that sort of thing before it happens? Because the decision had already been made when, after, you know, before you'd been informed about...
Well, let's be clear. This was not our operation. There was no reason for us to be involved.
Would you expect to be let in on
that? There were no UK assets involved, and it was perfectly right that it went ahead as it there's no reason for us to be notified. Our job, once it had happened, was to make clear our position, which was, you know, we're not going to weep hot tears over the death of a guy who has... who had the blood of British troops on his hands? Let's be frank. Nor, on the other hand, as I've just told you, do we want to see any kind of escalation in the Middle East,
which many will understand listening to you this morning, and some people watching this will say, you know, this was an opportunity for you to show leadership as Prime Minister. Did you think about coming back from your holiday?
Well, we had our job, my job, was to concert the UK response and the European response to make sure that the United States understood our perspective and to work very hard to ensure that there was no escalation. And I think when you look at what has happened in the days since the death of Qasem Soleimani, I think, you know, we are in a better place. That doesn't mean that the tensions aren't there. And the UK will continue to work for engagement and dialogue. Now, we're going to come under pressure. Everybody will say, well, you've got to get rid of this nuclear deal, the JCPOA, right? This is what Trump wants. Get rid of the JCPOA. My point to our American friends is, look, somehow or other, we've got to stop the Iranians acquiring a nuclear weapon. I think that's the most. That's what the Joint Collective Points Agreement does, the JCPOA. But if we're going to get rid of it, then we need a replacement. Now, the problem with the JCPOA is basically, and this is the crucial thing, this is why there's this tension. The problem with the agreement is that from the American perspective, it's a flawed agreement, it expires, plus it was negotiated by President Obama, and it has from their point of view, it has many, many faults. Well, if we're going to get rid of it, let's replace it. And let's replace it with the Trump deal.
Okay.
That's what we need to see. And I think that would be a great way forward. President Trump is a great dealmaker, by his own account and many others. Let's work together to replace the JCPOA and get the Trump deal instead.
Can I ask
that's
you about
the opportunity.
Your own deals? Do you think what's happened with General Soleimani, has that made it more difficult for Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe to return to the UK? I know it's something that you've been involved in during your previous jobs as well.
No, absolutely. I think the SEO, we all work very hard to secure the release of a number of very difficult consular cases, including Nazanin. I'm seeing Richard Ratcliffe, her husband, very soon. It's hard to say whether the death of Qasem Soleimani has actually made that particular case more or less difficult. I mean, I think Richard has his views. Others have different views. Let's see how we go.
It's hard to say because obviously it's made it more difficult. It's made lots of things more difficult. But he's really now saying, Martin, isn't he, that, well, the idea that the European nations are going to stay in the JCPOA and isolate the Americans, really, and saying, well, we think this is still a good deal, that's out the window now. He's now for a new deal, a new Trump deal.
Yeah, but I mean, the Americans were already laughing in his face on that one. I mean, it's just delusionary if he imagines he's going to persuade the Americans to do a deal. They don't want to do a deal. They want regime change. That's why they killed Soleimani, without bothering to tell the British. And, of course, when we're talking about sovereignty, we've got the Irish Guards in Iraq, as I mentioned earlier. They're training the Iraqi army, who also work very closely with the PMUs, you know, the Popular Mobilization Units, which were attacked by the Americans at the start of this crisis. And I can imagine that they're probably just sitting in their base now, trying unable to go anywhere. They need to come home. Anyway, Boris Johnson needs to bring the Irish Guards home, and we need to get out of this alliance.
Well, they almost
seemed
like they were
going to
do that, but no, it didn't happen quite. But anyway, James Jatras is one of
don't
the
come home, then I can maybe come in.
James Jatras is one of the first analysts to popularise the term "the deep state" as distinct from Congress and the president, a kind of permanent government by banks and corporations and the revolving door into think tanks and the big universities. And I spoke to him about the recent conflict over the assassination of General Soleimani, which the Americans are still trying to say was not an assassination, and whether there could be any kind of independent British policy to that as a reaction to that horrific event, which could potentially have started a world war.
My name is Jim Jatras. I am a lawyer by training, although I've never practiced. I served at the State Department for about 6.5 years, including in the Office of Soviet Union Affairs, and then I worked for over 17 years for the Republican leadership at the U.S. Senate as a foreign policy analyst for the Republican leadership on every foreign policy topic you can think of. Since I left government service in the early 2000s, I worked as a Washington lobbyist and as a media and policy analyst in various capacities. Right now, I would say I'm retired or semi-retired. I hope what I have to say doesn't sound too radical to some listeners, but maybe I was a naive fellow in 1991 when the first Cold War ended. I expected that the world would go back to something like a non-ideological pre-1914 type of order without all the crazies messing up the planet. It didn't occur to me at the time that my own country would take the lead in becoming the new crazy ideological power and trying to impose its will on the rest of the planet in the name of democracy, human rights, and free markets, and all that sort of thing. Yes, we are in a new Cold War, not a kind of new Cold War. We are in a new Cold War that is actually far more dangerous than the old one, because in the old one, despite the ideological differences between the West and the Soviet bloc, there was still a high degree of respect for state-to-state norms of relationships between the two blocs. And honestly, far more deference was given to the communist Soviet government than has been given to post-communist Russia, which was treated with contempt in the aftermath of the breakup of the Soviet Union, first as essentially a vassal state under Yeltsin, and then under Putin, when it refused to be a vassal state anymore, as an enemy. And that's the way it's regarded now. And the entire structure of relations, especially arms control agreements, were getting along during the first Cold War and avoiding the prospect of war, has been dismantled. And I think we're in a far more dangerous period than almost anything we saw during the first Cold War, except perhaps during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Some people now say that the U.S. actually wants global hegemony, that on every continent, that the U.S. is trying to dominate the planet. Do they really think they can do that?
Yes, they do. And again, I put Donald Trump in a different category. We can talk about him, but in terms of the U.S. establishment, yes, absolutely, that's the way they think. And a lot of them, I think, are so arrogant. And remember, I've worked with these people. I've known many of them for 3 decades. That they are so arrogant in that they are right about everything. It never really occurs to them that, wait a minute, why does, say, the South China Sea or Syria or Ukraine or someplace in Central Asia matter more to the United States than it does to China or Russia or Iran or some other power for whom this is their neighborhood? I mean, look, people talk about the Monroe Doctrine, where we basically said to the European powers, stay out of our hemisphere. We are the most secure of the great powers. The question is, why are we meddling around in areas that are of zero interest to the United States and to our national security, but are of vital interest to other powers? And essentially stepping on their toes. If you look at, classic diplomacy of the 19th century, when you have, for example, the Wakhan Corridor in Afghanistan between the Russian and British empires, or the neutrality of Siam between the British and the French empires, that's how diplomacy is conducted. We don't know how to do that. In fact, we reject it in principle. There was a great article in 1996 by Bill Kristol and Robert Kagan called "A Neo-Reaganite Foreign Policy," where they call, this is a direct quote, for benevolent global hegemony by the United States, and said that the goal of that hegemony is to perpetuate it for the foreseeable future. It is a self-justifying goal. And that, I would say, is the mentality of the Washington establishment.
If that is pursued, that kind of attitude to foreign policy, it's going to end in war, Jim.
Exactly. I wrote a piece a few months ago called war with Russia is not inevitable. Just keep repeating that. I think the way these people think about not only Iran or Venezuela, but Russia and even China, is that all we have to do, or North Korea, we just have to exert maximum pressure, keep the sanctions on, surround them with bases, make the security situation untenable, and that sooner or later, either they will run up the white flag and agree to become vassals of Washington, or they will crack. They will suffer a regime change, and the same result will be achieved. And if you ask them, well, what if that doesn't work? What if just pressuring and threatening doesn't work? Their answer isn't, well, maybe then we need to find some way to have a modus vivendi where we actually respect their legitimate interests. That doesn't even occur to them. It just comes back to, well, then we must try harder. And I don't think they really take seriously the possibility that this could erupt into war. I hope people at the Pentagon take that seriously, but the policy-making establishment doesn't really seem to take that serious.
What about, particularly with in relation to Iran, we've seen quite a big change this week, literally, in policy, with the European powers that are involved in the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, now saying, led by Boris Johnson, that actually maybe the best thing to do is to scrap the JCPOA and to renegotiate a deal along the lines that Trump was wanting.
Yes, and this was where we get to some of the complexity of Mr. Trump and his essentially running against the errors of our foreign policy for the last, you know, three decades or so when he ran for president in 2016. But then, unfortunately, it seems following more or less the very same policy and in some ways even intensifying it once he got into office. I think with respect to Iran, like with regard to North Korea, he would really like a deal. As he says, a much better deal. I don't think there's a single person around him in administration who shares that view. They take the view that Iran must be crushed one way or the other, that there must be regime change or that Iran must be destroyed as a power. And there will be no much better deal with Iran. I think also, especially with impeachment, he has a lot less running room to buck the system, to go against the wishes of the deep state. So I think he sort of walked into this confrontational policy, and then we saw with his statement after the last coming up to the edge of war with Iran that he wants Russia, China, the European countries also to dump the JCPOA. Obviously, Russia and China will not do this. I don't know what the British and French will think, but the British, partly because of Brexit and because of Britain's distancing itself from the rest of Europe, which, by the way, I tend to support in general, but that also then almost by definition moves them closer to American policy. And I think there is a rapport between Johnson and Trump personally. So I think that what you described is a reflection of that. I think the real question is, what will the rest of Europe do? Just as we see the British and French beginning to think in terms of baby steps of moving away from American policy on Russia, we'll see whether they can actually grow a pair and distance themselves from us on Iran. But so far, they talk a good fight.
Who is the deep state? What is the deep state? And what is it that keeps driving it? Because it doesn't look as if it seems to be affected at all by the democratic institutions, that is to say, either the press or elections.
I wrote a very lengthy paper in 2016, September 2016, about how the American media served as a transmission belt for wars of choice. And a central part of that was describing the deep state. And that concept went from almost like an unheard of conspiracy term at one point and almost immediately to kind of a hackneyed buzzword that has been overused. But it basically is a description of what we might call the American version of the Soviet nomenklatura, which is all of the organs of influence and power that's much broader than just Eisenhower's military-industrial complex, which, by the way, he originally included Congress in that as well, but includes, you know, information technology, the financial system, the media themselves, most of them, that basically it is a structure, interlocking structure of power, the think tanks, the NGOs, with a remarkable revolving door of personnel and privilege that go from sector to sector, you know, one at one point to a university, next time to Congress, next time appointed to an executive branch job, and then maybe over to something in the financial sector, maybe something in the IT world, all of whom know each other and whose test of orthodoxy is their support for a common program of domination that has been built up over several decades. So it's very, you know, it would be very hard to describe a significant organ of power in Washington that is not somehow either part of or a fellow traveler with the structure.
So where does that leave democracy? Where does that leave the people? Surely, you know, we need to yeah. have a system whereby the government that represents us actually represents us, rather than it simply presents us regularly with somebody to vote for who's working for them.
Well, exactly right. And, of course, I think we saw that in the 2016 election, not only with Trump sort of running against that tendency in his own party. I think Bernie Sanders attempted to do that in the Democratic Party. And, of course, we saw that he got very badly treated by his party. We'll see what he does this time. But, I don't know, Tony, there's an answer to this. Because, look, I'm not a very strong supporter of the concept of democracy as it's generally well known, which seems to be generally just sort of a facade for some sort of oligarchy. And that's, you know, the idea that you can put somebody in there through ballots who will actually change the direction of policy, I think is probably not realistic. That's what Trump was supposed to do. He promised us America first and said he gave us, Israel and Saudi Arabia first and the same policies that have brought us to ruin and to the brink of global war. And he does not, some people say, look, he was a fraud to start with. He never really meant it. I tend not to believe that, because why does he keep making trouble for himself by saying he doesn't want to do this? Let's get out of Syria. Let's get out of Afghanistan, which he never managed to seem to do. So I think at some place in his heart, he wants to do the right thing, but it almost doesn't really matter whether he wants to or not. What matters is it hasn't happened, and I don't think it will.
What about the Israelis? Because it's a very close relationship between Israel and the United States. I think it's $3.5 billion a year going from the U.S. to keep Israel going.
I don't think I'm giving you any state secrets to say that Israel has a tremendous amount of influence with the American government. That only includes a lot of money for groups like AIPAC or certain oligarchs like Sheldon Adelson, Paul Singer, and so forth. But a huge constituency in the Republican Party of Christian evangelicals, for whom uncritical, unexamined, unqualified support for any Israeli policy is considered an absolute divine mandate. And this is a huge factor on Capitol Hill, but between both politicians who openly embrace support for Israel as a divine necessity and those who are terrified crossing the Israeli lobby for fear they're going to get a primary opponent when they run for re-election and very likely defeat it. So it's a very huge point of influence. It's kind of ironic, given that all today, was the impeachment trials getting set to be underway, we're hearing all this talk about Russia trying to skew our elections, when not just the Israelis, but the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Turks and the Indians and the Pakistanis, so many countries have a thumb in their pie through their various points of influence over our government. The Israelis are the 800-pound gorilla in that regard, but they're far from the only one. Our Congress is a souk. It's a free market of foreign interests that buy and sell favors like people sell, well, I don't know what they sell in Britain, but here they sell vintage baseball cards.
What about the recent debacle over the assassination of General Soleimani in Iraq? What's your take on the legalities and the precedents that assassination set, and what do you think of the way that the Iranians have reacted to it?
I can't think of any grounds on which it would be legal. The those who justify his killing say, look, he killed he was responsible for the killing of American soldiers in Iraq. You know, after all, because we were there bringing democracy to that country, and anybody opposed us must be a terrorist. Therefore, he was supporting terrorism. So he should have been killed for that. Others were saying he was planning attacks on Americans, so that would justify his elimination, although the proof for that is rather sketchy. We get back into this business about, can you really believe anything that comes from our intelligence services.
Well, as I understand it, there's been no intelligence presented to show that.
Well, exactly, and there never is. Just like when they say, 17 agencies or four agencies say the Russians hacked our election. Well, there's no evidence for that. You know, well, the Syrians use chemical weapons. Where's the evidence for that? I'm not one of those who will take that on faith. Maybe I'm not patriotic enough. But in any case, the bit about his killing Americans in Iraq, the other way to look at that is when you're occupying a country and some of the locals there don't want you there and they're fighting against you and you have an insurgency, is anybody who helps them from the outside then marking himself for death? By that standard, any American, Israeli, Saudi, Turkish, etc. politician who was involved in giving aid to the, to the terrorists in Syria fighting against the government, would the Syrian government then have the right to assassinate any of those civil or military officials because they're killing Syrian civilians and soldiers? That would be the argument. We're now at the point where apparently our government thinks it's okay to assassinate foreign officials of countries with whom we are not at war.
And what about the Iranian reaction? Because they attacked air bases. Nobody was killed in Iraq.
I think what the Iranians did was essentially what Trump did when he hit the two times he struck at Syria after what appear to have been phony claims of chemical weapons use. And he deliberately, he felt he had to do something, but he deliberately tried to do something that would not kick off a whole round of retaliation and open warfare. I think the Iranians did that as a demonstration, say, yes, we can hit you anytime we want to, but on this occasion, we are not going to kill any of you. But I think the real retaliation will be more like a death of a thousand cuts here and there in Iraq that can't necessarily be pinned on the Iranians, because I think they're thinking strategically. They want us out of Iraq, and if we get out of Iraq, we have to get out of Syria, too. I think they're playing the longer game. The question is what will the next step be, and whether, again, the cabal around Trump will succeed the next time in getting them to do what they clearly want him to do, and I think he clearly does not want to do, which is to directly attack Iran and get this war started.
What would be your advice to people at the Foreign Office and British officials who now feel that whilst they're just about to leave the European Union, there's going to be some kind of closer relationship with the United States? What would be your advice to those who are having to deal with the United States over the coming years into making sure that relationship is a relationship of mutual respect rather than of, you know, some kind of empire and a kind of slave country?
You know, that's a very difficult question because, first off, if I were British, I guess I would not advocate a closer relationship with the United States as the sort of the alternative to a closer relationship with Europe. I would, as much as possible, want to promote British sovereignty, British independence, and maybe a British equidistance from various centers of power, not only the United States and the European Union, but Russia and China and other places. Maybe that's naive to think that a relatively smaller power, but not an insignificant one, can pursue an independent policy like that. I think that would be the, if you will, the patriotic thing to do. Unfortunately, I think you're right. It will mean closer relationship with Washington. And I think that's a two-edged sword. On the one hand, as you say, it means sort of this imperial shadow that would be cast over Britain, where you get to be the junior partner, the Tonto to our Lone Ranger on everything. On the other hand, I think we sometimes see that there's an interesting, almost in the same sense that the Israelis or the Saudis and other countries have a great deal of influence over Uncle Stupid. The British do too. I of course can't help but notice how much a British involvement there was with the whole, you know, Steele dossier and this whole what I consider to be a deep state anti-constitutional conspiracy to sink the Trump presidency and the involvement of people in MI6 and GCHQ. When we look at, for example, the Five Eyes structures of the UK, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, you sort of wonder sometimes if this deep state is not confined to one country, but rather it's an international structure, really, that involves people in more than one country.
I just wonder if you've got any insight into the way the intelligence services operate, because they do seem to come from the same page nowadays with very little to put between the policies in the different NATO countries.
I'm not a former intelligence officer, although I do know a great many former American intelligence officers, and the sense I have is that there are distinctions, as you find, for example, in law enforcement, like at the FBI, where I would say almost all of the people at the working levels or the professional levels are very good people who do their job with a lot of integrity and professionalism and patriotism. But the further you go up in any structure, and this is true of the military, too, for that matter, you know, you find politicians, and they basically are tailoring the truth or even tailoring the intelligence to meet the political needs at the moment. And, you know, I guess I first became conscious of that during the Balkan War in the 1990s, when, you know, you had the most incredible lies coming out of American and British intelligence to justify what the policymakers wanted to do. And certainly we saw that in Iraq, and we see that in Syria and so forth. We see, for example, MI6's role with respect to the White Helmets, who I think have been correctly called the public relations arm of Al-Qaeda in Syria. So, you know, I don't want to demean in any way the professionals in these services, but I don't have a whole lot of respect for the politicians who run these agencies. And as I say, I think they fit into the, sort of this much broader nomenclatura in other countries. And as far as NATO and the rest of that go, you're right. I don't know that we ever got formally one intelligence service for all the NATO countries, but I don't think there's any question that the intelligence services of all the NATO countries, I'm thinking like BND in Germany and so forth, are penetrated by and essentially controlled by the CIA and the American intelligence community. The best place to follow my work is first off on Twitter at Jim Jatras. And then if you go to Strategic Culture Foundation and look me up on the author list under J, and also to chroniclesmagazine.org. I haven't posted anything there recently, but I have a number of articles there as one of the bloggers.
Okay, Jim Jatras, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Martin, tremendous amount in there, but one of the points I'd tease out is that he's talking about Russia hacking the elections, Syria using chemical weapons. These are some of the big conspiracy theories of the last few years, but the mainstream media is still peddling these. They're lies.
Yes, they are. And of course, what's gradually happening is that people are getting inured to a basically false reality. People like us who follow things in detail and people like him are very well aware. I mean, basically, there's a kind of an elite of people, if you like, who are very well aware of what's going on. But the ordinary population, basically, are being bamboozled.
So the mainstream media right across the West, really, is starting to present us with theatre rather than actual news.
Well, it's always been a bit like that, but of course it's getting more and more extreme because, you know, the whole concept of psychological warfare used to be a kind of, you know, a sort of quirky little bit that you tacked onto your military, but it's now become central to the way in which you know, PR and psychological warfare are two sides of the same coin.
At the end of the day, though, I mean, this lies the Americans would call BS. There's nobody left to lie to. Most people certainly who are involved in running countries and, you know, serious opinion formers around the world in any kind of independent countries know that most of this is lies. I mean, it's potentially the Americans are running out of people to lie to.
Well, they are, but they don't care. I mean, what they really need to do is just, Abraham Lincoln said, you can fool some of the people all of the time and all of the people some of the time. And they just have to fool the right people at the right time to carry on doing what they want to do. And that's how they think of it.
Now, the other thing is he's talking also there about, particularly in the Republican Party, the Christian evangelicals, I would call, I think more correctly, Christian Zionists, talking about support for Israel being a divine necessity. Now, this is a very interesting form of fundamentalism that we don't hear that much about, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the reason we don't hear much about it in this country is it would be very, you know, public opinion in this country isn't really of that ilk. And certainly the Christian churches in this country certainly wouldn't, by and large, wouldn't subscribe to those views. But what happens is we get a bowdlerized version of the US. You know, they're cookie and crazy, but you'll like us if you get to know us, you know. And, well, you know, we've always been great friends with them. But at the same time, of course, the more we're exposed to actual people from the US in senior positions, people like Pompeo, for example. He said, you're just a gangster, aren't you? Because they are. They're just gangsters.
Also, last weekend, or weekend before last, when we had this assassination of Soleimani and the attack on the US air bases in response, we also saw that at the same time that the Iranians hit the US bases, they issued a threat saying, well, if you respond to this, we will attack Dubai and Haifa. So that's UAE and Israel. So they were making absolutely clear what the next step would be if there was any response from the US or the West or NATO countries.
Yeah, I mean, from their point of view, I think that was... it's obviously absolutely tragic that this airline has been shot down, although we're still looking at the detail of all of that.
Well, we'll talk about it in a second, but what about this idea that they're saying, if you want to escalate it, this is where it's going, Dubai and Haifa?
Well, I mean, it's quite obvious. They're saying, if you attack us, we are going to fire back, which what could have happened in Syria last year or in 2014 when the so-called chemical weapons attack. The agreement was that neither the Syrian Arab army nor the Russians would respond, but they could have done. They could easily have done, and they could have fired back at Akrotiri, for example, the RAF base in Cyprus, which the Cypriots don't want.
And what
do
you make then of the shooting down of PS752, the Ukrainian airliner, something like 170 people dead?
Well, obviously, I've been following this very closely. I was on RT last week before we knew what was actually going on. I was saying, well, don't jump to conclusions. And the fact is, there's a Russian website which is actually run by air warfare specialists, and they're saying that we think that the Americans were able to infiltrate by, you know, electronic methods, the Iranian air defences and civil aviation.
Well, that's just stretching a point. I mean, one thing I have heard...
I'm not saying I agree with them. The original
announcement included a little clause saying that the Iranians are saying that their... air defences had been, the communications had somehow been jammed so that they couldn't actually get through to the people who fired the missile.
Well, that's right. And I think what they've done is they've basically recognised that if their missile hit the plane, there's no use going on about stuff like that. It's basically a cock-up and you've got to put your hand up. But on the other hand, there's still questions about what happened there. Don't forget that the US were flying hostile missions just outside Iranian airspace.
Now, remember that
what we're being told
is that the Iranian people are having lots and lots of demonstrations right across the country. We heard just on the news, literally a couple of hours ago, that there are these demos going on. And even the British ambassador was arrested briefly this week.
Yes, that's because he went to one of the demos, and you're not supposed to do that. That's obviously going
The British say that he was just going to get his hair cut. Okay, it was midnight. But
yeah, well, I mean, if the Iranian ambassador here was seen to be cheering on, pro-Irish Republican demonstrators, that would regard it a breach of protocol.
It's interesting as well that there was big Stop the War demo in London with about 2,000 people last Saturday outside the BBC. The BBC didn't report that, but they did report 500 people in Tehran demonstrating against
There you go. Isn't that interesting? And of course, they all reported that millions turned out for Soleimani's funeral, so many that 50 people were killed in the crush. But, of course, we've forgotten all about that.
You know,
this has
been going on for a long time. I can remember around about 1997, we went down to the big motorway between Shepherd's Bush and the M40 or the A40. I can't remember what it's called there. But anyway, we shut it down with a Reclaim the Streets protest, and we were literally waving at the BBC newsroom across there. So there'd be a whole road shut down by a protest with a massive sound system. And it was great fun, and we shut the road. It was always one of these sort of anti-car things, basically. No reporting at all by the BBC, even though they could see us clearly from the newsroom window.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of what's going on is spin and psychological warfare.
But I suppose you don't know what you're not told.
Yeah.
I can always remember a Danish guy telling me that one of their great, well-respected TV news presenters, and of course most of the people we see on television now doing the news have got no real track record in doing hard-nosed investigative reporting or anything like that. They're just what Dennis Potter would call glorified bus conductors. And what he said was that when he retired, his last night on the news, he said, folded his arms and he said, and that is what we decided to tell you tonight. And it's rather like that now, isn't it? There's all sorts of stuff which has just been literally put in the bin, which you're not going to be told about because it's embarrassing to government or elites or the establishment.
That's right. But, of course, with the internet, there are alternative voices out there. I mean, we're one of them, and we just heard your colleague from the US earlier. People can find out the information, But on the other hand, they're not going to make, you know, people with busy lives have only got a certain amount of time in their day to look into things, and therefore they're easily told lies. And they're, you know, as P.T. Barnum said, there's one born every minute.
A great article in The Intercept just popped up. A key architect of the 2003 Iraq war policy is now a key architect of Trump's Iran policy. And this, of course, is the deep state that Jim Jattras was talking about. David Wormser. Now, there's a guy with a great name, a Diet of Wormser. David Wormser, W-U-R-M-S-E-R, was a longtime advocate of war with Iraq in the Bush administration. Eventually, he got what he wanted. It was a total disaster. Now, Wormser, again, has the ear of the president, this time Donald Trump, and his sights are set firmly on Iran. I'll put a link up to that on our show page, but this just shows you exactly what Jim is talking about when he's talking about the deep state.
Well, that's right. And of course, the opponents of the US are very well aware of what's going on. And they are, they've got their own countermeasures to try and deal with it. But it is very difficult when you've got the major power on the planet being run by criminal gangsters. How are we going to deal with it? Big question.
Well, we're going to have a look now at Israel, and particularly this story I mentioned at the top of the hour, to do with a Channel 13 investigative report from Israeli television with hidden cameras filming rabbis at the Sons of David Army Seminary. A really good article, actually detailed article, on the alarabi.co.uk website, entitled "The US and Israel's Radical Right Connection to the World's Most Racist Rabbis." Anyway, this is all in Hebrew, so I've voiced it up, and there's a little clip from this Channel 13 report now.
How do they see the Holocaust, though? The Holocaust was not about killing the Jews. Nonsense. And that is, it was systematic and ideological. Makes it more moral than random murder. The real Holocaust is pluralism. To believe in man, that is the Holocaust. Rabbi Giora Radler's definition of Holocaust, for years, God has been screaming that the diaspora is over, but Jews aren't obeying. That is their disease that the Holocaust must cure. With this lesson entitled Relating to the Holocaust, he teaches his students about the Nazis and Hitler. The Nazi logic was internally consistent. Hitler said that a certain group in society is the cause of all the evil in the world, and therefore it must be exterminated. You think this ideology is illogical? Very bad. It sounds immoral. Who was Moses, as cruel and evil as Hitler? No. There is only one evil in the world, hypocrisy. Why would you care how you're killed? With knives or with gas chambers? The students are shocked and try to refute him, but the rabbi just keeps going. Was Hitler righteous or not? No. Hitler was the most righteous. Of course Hitler was right in every word he said. His ideology was correct. There's masculinity, which is about respect and war. And there's femininity, which is soft and moral. Nazis said Jews were the latter, and thus the enemy.
So that's just a clip from that Channel 13 report. It's from roughly last Easter, Martin. Pretty shocking to see such incredible racism and, in fact, anti-Semitism right in the heart of the Jewish education system at the Sons of David Seminary.
Well, I think, much as I oppose Israeli policy, I think that is not representative of general views in Israel. And, of course, I don't really agree with the generality of opinion in Israel, but those people are crazy. Very dangerous people, aren't they?
And what the report says is that people who are very close to the Sons of David Seminary are, this is back in Easter last year, but they were saying that they're threatening to take over the Israeli education system.
Well, that's right. I mean, what's sadly happened in Israel over the years is they've become more and more belligerent and more racist towards Arabs and Muslims.
Okay, it's our final item tonight, looking at the nuclear weapons that were produced at the very end of the Second World War. On the night of the 12th of May, 1945, German U-234 was a submarine commanded by Lieutenant Captain Johann Heinrich Fehler, was transporting 560 kilograms of precious Nazi-enriched uranium U-235 encased in gold from the Baltic to Japan. The day after Bormann arrived in the UK, Martin, it changed course and went to the United States, which I thought was an amazing coincidence. Anyhow, that's it for this week. This time to sign off for the US-owned Comcast News. at 8. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Mike Davis, Labour councillor. We're online at thisweek.oneword.org.uk, where you'll find story links and show page. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the politics show.